I think I have to do it again. Make a summary of this weekend's theme, because some devotees have joined us. More kirtan, more kirtan, more kirtan.
He saw Jagannath face on his t-shirt.
It's okay. Jai Jagannath, Jai Jagannath. Okay. The theme is the lotus feet of Krishna being represented by the literary form of the transcendent Lord in the form of Srimad Bhagavatam. Srimad Bhagavatam being the literary incarnation of the Lord should be approached as one should approach the deity form of the Lord, beginning at the Lord's lotus feet. When taking darshan, the instruction is like that. And when performing worship, according to the rules of deity worship, before one approaches the deity in your home, the formality is certainly there when worshiping the deity on the altar. One requests permission on behalf of the spiritual master, as service to the spiritual master, to approach the deity form, because the pure devotee is at the Lord's lotus feet. And with those mantras being recited and in that mood of submission to the spiritual master and service to the spiritual master, one approaches the lotus feet of the deity. And placing one's hand upon the feet of the deity and offering various items to the feet of the deity, one then begins the worship of the deity. So like that in deity worship, the sound representation form of the Lord should be approached in that way. And Shukadev Goswami does. And Vyas, the literary incarnation of the Lord, composing Srimad Bhagavatam, approaches at the lotus feet of the Lord. And approaching the lotus feet of the Lord means that one has access to serve Him. It's in that mood, in the mood of the humble servant of the Lord, that one approaches the Supreme Lord in His, whatever the form, the name form, the deity form, the literary form. And so, the first and second cantos, our acharyas have described, they are the lotus feet of the Lord. Pada Padma. So, our theme is to approach the lotus feet of the Lord by hearing Shukadev Goswami. The first canto is before Shukadev Goswami speaks. It's the warm-up. It's just a warm-up. It's the essence of Srimad Bhagavatam laid out. Prabhupada came to America with that first canto in three volumes. Now in our full edition, it's one volume. And he said, everything that you need to go back to Godhead is in this volume. One becomes conversant with the subject matter of the first canto, you have your ticket and your visa and your passport. You just have to get on board. The second canto is restating by Shukadev Goswami speaking in the first three chapters especially. It's the essence of that message once again, only spoken by Shukadev. And so up to this fourth of the series so far, we've been touching on essences because that's what Shukadeva Goswami presents. The question that he's responding to, because the Bhagavatam is framed in the format of questions-answers from the very beginning, first chapter, second chapter, third chapter, answers. So similarly, the whole of the Bhagavatam. At the end of the 19th chapter of the first canto, Maharaj Parikshit has asked, for the benefit of all of my citizens, not just for my own self, what is the best means of preparing oneself to have that event happen where the soul separates from the body and the soul should go to its ultimate destination? What's the best means to prepare oneself? So that question immediately connects with what we're going to hear this evening, the verses Shukadeva Goswami speaks. What should one hear about, remember, worship, meditate upon as a subject matter? And conversely, what should one not do? It's always nice to know what not to do, along with what to do. What enhances it the most, and what detracts from it? Anukulyasya sankalpa, pratikulyasya varjanam. According to the Padma Purana, there are six different angas of surrender, and one of them is to do that which is favorable to devotional service. And explicitly, it's implicit, but it's stated explicitly, and to reject things that are not favorable to devotional service. Those are limbs of surrender. We were speaking earlier about sincerity. There's a demonstration of sincerity. I hear something that's favorable. I accept it. I apply it. I live by it. I make it, I incorporate it within my life. I carry it within my heart and live my life accordingly. And something is unfavorable, you set it aside. So, I don't think I'm going to do a complete review. I'll just say that there's a very important verse that we discussed midday today, and I'd like to cover it because it's so important. There's a term in Sanskrit composition that indicates towards the beginning of some literature, there's a statement, a vakya, that's the principal utterance that sets the mood for all of that composition. So the second canto has this very important statement made by Shukadeva Goswami that it's tandem with the process of devotional service, but it's specific. The specific practice or limb of devotional service is chanting the holy name, Shravanam Kirtanam. Now, in the purport that Prabhupada has provided us with, he refers to Jiva Goswami, and in his Sat Sandarbhas, one of them is Bhakti Sandarbha, and in his Bhakti Sandarbha he explains there are nine processes, but of these nine processes, one is most important, and that most important one is chanting. Prabhupada has taught in Nectar Devotion that any one of the nine processes of bhakti, all of them, eight of them, seven of them, six of them, down to any one of them, is sufficient to carry one to love of God, the fruit of devotion. Jiva Goswami adds, but any one of them must be also accompanied by chanting. Deity worship, must be accompanied by chanting. If you're engaged in hearing, it must be accompanied by chanting. Remembering, what precedes remembrance is chanting and so forth. Prayer, hearing and chanting. So, chanting is the most important. The verse that we covered this afternoon, Etan nirvidyamana nam, ichitam akuto bhayam, yogi nam nripanir nitam, harir namanu kirtanam. So, in this verse, it parallels the verse that comes later in this canto, Akama sarvakamova mokshakama udaradi tivrena bhakti yogena yajeta purusham param. Meaning, there's one thing that's good for everybody, and that's tivra bhakti. And it's good for persons who are akama, thank you very much. Okay. Sakama or moksha kama. Notice there's one thing that is central in all three. It's kama. Having all desires. In this verse, it's ichitam. Icha. Desire. Those who have, you name it, they've got it. Desire. And nirvidyamananam, those who are free from material desire. And yoginam, those that are self-situated and are perfectly satisfied. So those that want liberation, those that don't need anything at all, those that are filled with material desire. Whatever the position, chant the holy name. From the bottom of the spectrum, those who have, just like in Dhruva Maharaj's prayers, a similar idea. This just is just to help appreciate the poetry of the Bhagavatam. The message is embedded right here, and later on the essence idea is vistarani, the phrase that Bhaktivinoda Thakur uses. It's expanded. The Bhagavatam is just like an explosion of these essences of messages. Messages that are here in the first and second canto, just expanded upon by the narration so that we can understand from different angles of vision. Anybody here ever made Giwix? Probably half the people in the room here have made Giwix. Some people have made a lot of Giwix. Jars. So you take ghee and you take cotton and make a little wad and then dip it in the cotton, in the ghee, and you tighten and tighten and tighten and tighten and it becomes very tight. And you got your Giwix. So supposing you did it the other way around. You took the cotton and just fluffed it out. And you get so many strands and so many strands and so many strands. So the first two cantos of the Bhagavatam is the Giwik. And the other cantos is fluffing out the cotton. You have this strand and you have that strand and this strand and that. So many different strands that make up these essences that we find in the first two cantos of the Bhagavatam. And so if you are familiar with the first two cantos of the Bhagavatam, when you read the later cantos of the Bhagavatam, it's like, you know, a sound resonates way over here. It's, oh yes, that was the message from the first or the second canto of the Bhagavatam. And in fact, it's like a musical masterpiece where you just hint at the message even with one Sanskrit phrase, and it makes it resonate way over here. Like, I'm way off the subject, but I've watched a professional piano tuner, and the professional piano tuner pulls out this box, and they have a rubber mallet, and they have tuning forks, and they just hold the tuning fork in their hand, and go bonk, and it's, you know, the C, middle C, and then they just hold it near the string, and they see if the string vibrates in proper, you know, arcs. And if it's a long arc or if it's short arc, then they tighten it or shorten it, or tighten it or loosen it, and then bong. They don't have to touch the rubber mallet or touch the tuning fork to the string. They just hold it near the string and it just resonates and vibrates the string. So like that, the later cantos is the tuning fork, and the speaker is Shukadeva Goswami, and it's bong. And it resonates this first two cantos. If you're familiar with the first two cantos, if you've meditated very deeply on the message of the first two cantos, it's a wonderful orchestration piece. And likewise, if you hear somebody speak something that doesn't resonate properly, you know right away, this needs some tuning. Either that or you get a new tuning fork, sir. So it's the lotus feet. You can't go further with a life of devotion if you're not in a humble mood at the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord, being introduced to the essence of what the message of devotion is and how to approach it and how to understand the merciful Lord whose feet can't be beat. How sweet. Whatever. Etan nirvidyamananam ichatam akuto bhayam yoginam nripanir nitam harer namanukirtanam. Akuto bhayam, the akuta and abhaya, the doubtless and fearless path. If there's doubt, just read first and second canto Srimad Bhagavatam very, very carefully. Hear the message with great attention, and doubts will surface and doubts will disappear. And uncertainties and fears may arise, and uncertainties and fears will disappear. And that's not going to happen, factually speaking, unless one has shelter at the lotus feet of the Lord. And other position is a fearful position. A little anecdote. I was riding in a subway one day with Rupa Nuga. And the occasion was we were going to the court, the District Court of Queens, because the district attorney had brought a case. When we went to the district attorney, because somebody had kidnapped some of our members for brainwashing. Oh, excuse me, for the purpose of Ted Patrick and his gang, kidnapped some people, two devotees right off the street. Murti Vandya, Mary Lee Kreshauer, and her mother were shopping in Queens, and a van drove by, and three big goons jumped out of the back of the van and grabbed her around the waist and tossed her in the back of the van, and the van sped off to rescue her from the Hare Krishna movement. And they took her to a remote place upstate New York, and no sleep, and made her eat stuff that she would never eat, and yelled at her day and night and night and day and day and night, give up this thing. And finally, when they were asleep and she wasn't, she snuck out and came back to the temple and told the temple president what had happened. And he said, well, go report it to the police. The police gave it to the district attorney. The district attorney turned around and said, I charge the Hare Krishnas with kidnapping. They brainwashed this girl. They kidnapped her by brainwashing. So it was a charge against the Hare Krishna movement for brainwashing. Excuse me, for kidnapping. So I was writing. It got settled very nicely by Harvey Cox of the Harvard Divinity School wrote a letter to the New York Times, a letter to the editor, and it was published. And the judge read it. And 48 hours later, the judge made a ruling. Hare Krishna's this bona fide religion with this roots 5,000 years ago, and the practices are traditional, and someone who sees the practices such as this, traditional practices as brainwashing, is just a prejudicial individual and doesn't understand what religious tradition is. Case dismissed. Didn't even go to testimony. Prabhupada was prepared for testimony. He was happy. He wasn't intimidated. He was, this is great. We can broadcast what genuine religion really is in the courtroom. And it'll be recorded by the court reporter. And he had other ideas of testimony too. Leave that out. So I was riding with Rupanuga to the district court. And as we were riding in the subway, he got in this kind of mood, a Rupanuga mood. He was looking around the car and said, leaned over and said, all these people riding in this car, they have no idea where they're going. They think they're going to the such and such stop on the F train, but they don't know if they're going to get there. And what's waiting for them on the other side, they have no idea. The life of a person who is not protected by Krishna is completely fearful. And most of the persons, they're either ignorant or bluffing. But the existence is a fearful existence because at any moment, finished. And then he paused and said, but a devotee knows whatever may happen, Krishna's protective hand is always there. We're going to come into that in this evening's verses, the story of Katvanga Maharaj is where we're headed. So, Akuto Bhayam, Harer Namanu Kirtanam, the chanting of the holy name, doesn't say, live in Chicago and it's going to be, you know, tropical weather all winter long. That's not the promise. But Krishna's protection from the disturbances of material existence, that is, one inwardly can remain peaceful despite whatever externally is happening. Prabhupada told a story once about his own realization of this fact when he was a householder. Again, it's a little deviation, but it's a nice story. In one lecture, Prabhupada spent about 15 minutes describing how the British had artificially created a famine by buying up all the grains and hoarding them. And then the price of rice became twice. Then he gave a price. You know, normally the price of rice was something per kilo. Or it was more than twice. It was something like ten times. And so he was saying, a poor person who could afford a kilo of rice, when it was 10 times what it would normally cost, would starve because they couldn't afford 10 times the price. They could buy 1/10 of what they would normally require. So many people were starving. And it was, you know, an arrangement so that they could get more profit for rice at the cost of lives and other kinds of suffering and inconveniences. So Prabhupada said, I was very concerned as a householder, so I went to the temple, the Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's temple in that area, and I asked, are you okay? And they were so calm. They said, oh, we're fine. We have, because devote because Krishna is very kind. Krishna supplied so much. No, we're okay. Thank you. Prabhupada said, then I could understand. Although so many other people were in such hardship, Krishna's devotees were being protected because they're Krishna's devotees. So, in one sense, the pious people were protecting the devotees, and the impious people were causing the inconvenience. But Krishna's devotees were protected, which also, when I narrate the Katvanga story, which is Shukadeva Goswami identifies that story, you'll see how it's relevant. So the devotee is not fearful in any circumstance. Practical, yes. Fearful, no. Because whatever happens, ultimately, there's an arrangement of Krishna behind that something that's happening. It's an opportunity to serve, it's an opportunity to learn, an opportunity to grow, an opportunity to be Krishna's servant somewhere, doing something in some way. Because my life is but to serve Krishna. So as he wishes me to serve him, of course, that's a nice phrase to say, and then when hardship or difficulty comes, that's where the exam time comes. So Maharaj Pariksit is facing death. And how to face that fearful condition? It's the fearless condition, the fearless method. The doubtless and fearless method is chanting of the holy name. So the recitation of the scripture begins, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. The worship of deity begins, calling the name of the deity. Any process that we have, it's calling upon the holy name. And of course, that's our essential sadhana. We wake up in the morning, according to the scripture, the first sound vibration that should come from your mouth is the obeisances to the spiritual master and calling upon your worshipable deity by name, taking shelter there, just as a reflex. And you practice like that, and that becomes your consciousness. So, in the purport of this verse, we discussed there are some indications of offenses to be avoided. This constant chanting of the holy name, Prabhupada also indicates, is the offenseless chanting of the holy name. Because one will not be able to continue constantly chanting if one is offensive. One will not have taste. If one doesn't have taste, then one cannot continue. This question of taste was one of the questions we discussed. It's the byproduct. It's there. Taste is there when there's offenseless chanting. So, in the next purport, I'll read the next verse, and then there's some offenses, ways that Prabhupada describes these offenses that I'd like to share, because Prabhupada chose to share them. So just follow in his footsteps and it's a safe path, right? What is the value of a prolonged life which is wasted, inexperienced by years in this world? Better a moment of full consciousness, because that gives one a start in searching after his supreme interest. So that moment of full consciousness, this is a question now of value, or who is fortunate. Is one fortunate? Oh, he's lived a very, very, very long, long life of dull consciousness. classically Prabhupada would point to the tree that lives for hundreds of years, sometimes thousands of years. How fortunate, right? Is that a greater fortune, or the greater fortune is one moment of full consciousness? And to illustrate this, he points to Katvanga. So how does one access that moment of full consciousness? It's by this primary means of devotional service, of which the primary access to devotional service is through the medium of chanting the holy name. And the chanting of the holy name is most fully accessed when there's offenseless chanting. So, in the purport, Jiva Goswami has written his commentary, and Prabhupada refers to it, that here, as well as in Bhakti Sandarbha, so many references are there, as well as in this canto and in further cantos of the Bhagavatam, that the chanting of the holy name is the most effective means of eradication of all of one's past sins. You know, religions are their propaganda, or their message is how to become free from sins. And this message, the Bhagavad message, is by chanting the holy name. It's not a matter of just professing belief in something. All you have to do is say the magic words, I believe in da-da-da-da, and all of a sudden, all the sins that you've done, they just went away. And the chanting of the holy name, scripturally and practically speaking, has that effect. Just listening to a lecture or a room conversation with Prabhupada, was describing this to a group of priests. And he said, I was just in Australia, and the group of priests that met with me there were saying, Swamiji, how is this possible? Our young people, our own people, that had no interest at all in the church and our message, have now become mad after God. How is this? What magic have you done? How have you done this? And so, and Prabhupada was explaining to these other priests, this was in Rome, that it's no magic, it's just chanting of the holy name. And not only they're mad after God, but the impurities, the anartas, the unwanted things, they're gone. These same boys in Australia, the same boys in Italy, their whole life in America, wherever, their lives are made up of impure activities. And from chanting the holy name, those things are gone, because the heart is clear, and those things that are inside come out in the form of behaviors and attachments, just like what was explained earlier in this first chapter. It's gone. It's gone. Just from the chanting of the holy name. Of course, the chanting of the holy name, then this little qualification that it should be done offenselessly, is also there. So Prabhupada covers the second offense, the seventh offense against the chanting of the holy name, and I'd like to read what he writes. The first offense, he writes that one should neither blaspheme the devotees of the Lord, this is sadhu ninda, the blaspheme the devotees of the Lord who have dedicated their lives to propagating the holy name of the Lord, or hearing others who are engaged in belittling devotees of the Lord. So we don't tolerate, we don't just hang around when a non-devotee is speaking like that about a devotee, and we don't hang around when a devotee is doing that about a devotee. We don't engage in it ourselves, and we don't give oral reception, submissive oral reception, the passive oral reception to. Sometimes Prabhupada uses vilification, sometimes he uses blasphemy. Here, the language is belittling, criticizing, fault finding. You know, we have to be very careful so that we're not, our creeper of devotion is not being hurt, neither by doing nor by hearing others doing. So there's recommended procedures, 1, 2, or 3, and usually the third is you leave the place. One is you speak something. In expressing another perspective on that devotee. I just found myself doing that in a conversation with another individual, and you know, in the course of the conversation, here came this thing. So if you just hear the thing about another devotee and make no response, you're implicated. So don't implicate yourself. You don't necessarily have to get out the boxing gloves and, you know, start slugging away. But, you know, my response was, this devotee has added so much value to our association, to our service, to our organization, and to furthering the cause of Krishna consciousness. And I would like to see, you know, if there's something that they need to improve on, let's help them. Let's consider like that. It hurts your own creeper of devotion to be engaged in such things or to be present when others are engaged in such things. So the best is to create a culture where respect predominates, and when something needs to be corrected, then it's done in the proper way, in the proper mood, at the proper time and place. In simple language, my mother used to say, if you can't say something nice, don't say nothing at all. But then it's not just don't say nothing at all, then as you hold some bad feeling, and then it comes out in some other way. So it's not a complete good lesson from my mom, but good start. Best is to have a heart that's just always in the mood of service, and if there's some need for we're all in some need, we're all in need of improving ourselves, as I would wish others to help me improve myself, let me be some way helpful for others to improve themselves, or at least wish them well for that to happen somehow by Krishna's arrangement. And my first business is see where that same thing is within my own heart, and how can I make that pure? That's something I can attend to pronto. So now, a more standard rendering of the second offense, I'm going to read it because you heard me read the other one. The not bringing the name of Krishna into the jurisdiction of material comparisons. Any name of God is a valid, it carries the potencies of God. I want you not to discriminate. So here's the normal way that it's described. As far as distinguishing the Lord's holy name from the names of the demigods, the revealed scriptures disclose, Bhagavad Gita 10:41, that all extraordinarily powerful beings are but parts and parcels of the supreme energetic Lord Krishna. Except for the Lord himself, everyone is subordinate. No one is independent of the Lord. Since no one is more powerful than or equal to the energy of the supreme Lord, no one's name can be as powerful as that of the Lord. So this other description is, if one tries, make the mistake of taking names of the Lord and saying this one's in this position and that one's in another position, that's an offense. And conversely, taking the names of jivas or even Lord Shiva and considering they're the same as Vishnu, likewise, that's an offense. And then sinning on the strength of chanting, Prabhupada takes one more pass at that one. The powerful holy name of the Lord can certainly deliver one from sinful effects, but one who desires to utilize this transcendental potency of the holy name in one's sinister activities is the most degraded person in the world. Such persons are never excused by the Lord or by any agent of the Lord. So don't mess with that one. And it goes on in under the name of for service to God, atrocities are done. It's, you know, it's the history is filled with a whole parade of individuals and groups of individuals and nations and, you know, our own nation, this wonderful nation, in the name of, you know, righteousness. But it's not a new thing. It's the most abominable thing. So I had the opportunity at this Harvard Divinity School gathering to ask the person who was one of the panelists for the Islamic faith, who was an American man who just happens to be a professor in the Islamic faith, and he read something in Arabic for this panel thing that I was part of. I wanted to know for a long time, since this jihad thing started, I mean, since September 11th and then all those other things, the suicide bombers, is this scriptural or it's just it's something people made up? You know, scholars of Islam afterwards came up with this jihad notion that it's like, you know, you go to heaven if you kill yourself and kill other people. Is it really in the Quran or is it just a modern thing? You know, a new twist that somebody put a spin on it. And he was cautious in his reply, but the essence of it, with, you know, extracting the caution, was no, it's not. You know, because he's a Harvard professor and he's going to be quoted, so he has to be careful what he says. But it's not. But so those persons who, you know, they strap the bombs to their body and they go blow themselves up somewhere and, you know, Allah, Allah, and their body bursts into a billion pieces and so do everybody else's in the name of Allah. Most heinous of the offenses against the holy name. And a lot of people out there doing it. And people stand in the line to do it again. Not the same ones to do it. They're gonna wait a long time. They're gonna get a chance. There must be some special mocha for those people. So that's extreme. That's really radical. But, you know, we in our day-to-day lives should not think it's okay. In moderation. I've got another story. When I was young, very young, I think I was in second grade, we moved from one town to another town, and the priest of the church that we were in previously, the new priest came to meet our family. He came right to our home and shook Dad's hand and, you know, he patted me on the head and everybody in the family and got to meet the whole family. And then my mother asked, would you like some of this or some of that or some wine? And he said, some wine. So my eldest brother said, is it okay for a priest to have wine? And his answer was, in moderation. And then, the rationale of what moderation. And I was just, second grade, and I was thinking, this is ridiculous. If you say in moderation, then you can say in moderation about anything. And sure enough, the priest had to be driven out of town because in moderation, he was having affairs with other women's wives, other congregation members' wives. In moderation. So sinning on the strength in God's name, it's okay as long as it's not in excess. So I can drive home and I can stay in the middle of the road. It's okay. Not okay. Not okay. So as devotees, we need to understand anukulyasya-sankalpa, what is going to be favorable for devotional service, and take shelter of that. And what is not favorable for devotional service, we let go of that. Dismiss it. It's in due course of time, just it's gone. Because of the positive shelter-taking connection with the Supreme Lord. That's this offenseless chanting, or offenseless devotional service. Shuddha bhakti, or shuddha nam, by cultivating coming to the Supreme Lord in that way. Better one moment of that than a long lifetime that's devoid of that impetus. Because even that moment, the logic is, it will give one impetus for experiencing that unlimitedly, ceaselessly, to search out that kingdom of God where it's always eternally in that manner. So then we'll end with the example that Shukadeva Goswami gives, the example of Katvanga, the saintly king. Katvanga, after being informed that the duration of his life would be only a moment more, at once freed himself from all material activities and took shelter of the supreme safety. Gatavan abhayam harim abhayam, safety, fearless, shelter in Lord Hari. So the description that's given in the second canto purport here is expanded in the ninth canto. Katvanga was a king in the line from which just several generations later Dasarath and Ramachandra appeared. So that's the lineage that he comes from. He was a very powerful warrior, and he was, when the demigods were in difficulty, they invited him to please come and assist. And when he assisted, he was able to defeat whoever it was. It doesn't mention who the demigods wanted defeated. And so they offered him a benediction. Muchukunda requested a different benediction. But he also was a great devotee, so he got Krishna's association. But Katvanga, what's not mentioned here, but it is mentioned in the ninth canto, is Katvanga considered, the demigods want to offer me something of this heavenly region. But as far as I can see, they themselves are just enamored by all these opulences, and it's taking away from them the disposition of service to the Supreme Lord. as far as I'm concerned, I have only one wish. And that is, I value the association of saintly brahmanas more than my own life, more than my treasury, more than my possessions and family and kingdom and all worldly things. They don't mean to me as much as the association of saintly brahmanas, because in their association, the personality of Godhead, his presence is felt. And then he says that even when I was small, I had no inclination for irreligious activity or speculative knowledge. I was only interested in serving the personality of Godhead. So let me ask them this most important question, because it's certainly relevant to Shukadeva Goswami. When will I meet death? I want to be prepared. And the demigods had the answer. Oh, that's what you want? It's not going to happen in a moment. Oh. Now, because his life had been prepared, this is the lesson for us. Because his life had been prepared, cultivation of service to the personality of Godhead, thereby causelessly detachment from other things, bhakti parishanu bhavo viraktir anyatracha, from the process of hearing the glories of the Lord, the natural devotion awakens in the heart. Feelings of transcendental emotion, para isha anubhav, are manifest causelessly. It just happens. You don't have to try to get some feelings. Those feelings will come for the person of para isha, the supreme controller, anubhav. Transformations of the body and the heart will take place just from hearing, and detachment from other things. So Katvanga was already there. He was detached from other, he was doing services, because that's what this body is for doing services for others. Whatever one's position, we serve others. That's our constitutional position. That's what we do with this body. We serve others. But when the notice was, you're going to leave this body in a moment, he withdrew his, just like Bhishma Dev, voluntarily withdrew his consciousness from all those activities and consolidated his full concentration upon the personality of Godhead and left his body and went back to Godhead. Prabhupada writes that in the ninth canto, this is very instructive, this example of Katvanga, because in Katvanga's case, he had just a moment. In Maharaj Prikshit's case, he had a week. So he could, the message here, Shukadeva Goswami is indirectly saying, hey, you've got a whole week. But, you know, that whole week, because his whole lifetime had been devoted to the personality of Godhead. But many persons in the world today think becoming very serious about spiritual life is for when you get old. It's common. It's a common notion. Some young people I've spoken to have told me like that. Oh, I'm fully confident. Now is this stage of life, and when I'm later, this is the doership mentality. Whatever I put my mind to, I'm always able to accomplish. And so when I get old, I'll just, you know, get serious about spiritual life. Now it's, you know, I'm earning wealth and taking care of my family, and I'll worry about spiritual life later. So, wait a minute, you better cultivate it now. No. And they meant it, and they're still doing it. And they're struggling. In their family life, they're struggling. In their business life, they're struggling. In their, there's just Daivi Asia, Gunamayi Mama Maya Duratyaya. And it's not that you get notice and then, okay, one, two, three. Attachments are very deep. I was just spent, before I came to Chicago, I was in Boston, and I was with, spent some time, I was picked up at the airport by the temple president, who's Nimai Nitai, and he's, Premananda knows Nimai Nitai, he's an Ayurvedic doctor. You dealing with him at all? With this health initiative? You, Maraji Tanya, okay, so Nimai Nitai, he's an MD, and he specialized in Ayurvedic medicine. He was married, and he's now taken Vanaprastha life, and he's living, he's the temple president in the Boston temple. And he said, you know, Maharaj, it's not easy. You know, my wife and I were, I don't know what happened, divorced or separated, or she died or something, you know, 12 years ago. But, you know, making the step from what my life was to what my life is, even now, it's you know, it's not easy. And I love full engagement in devotional service, and if I didn't have full engagement in devotional service, I don't know how I would do this. Yeah, but it's, you know, so many years of living in the midst of attachment to go to that stage of, and he's strong. He's a very smart man. Very, very strong intelligence, strong-willed, very compassionate. And, you know, his message is, I'm sharing this with you, attachments are very, very deep. Or here's another one. Tamahar and Mantrini. I visited them in Alachua just before Boston. And they live in DeKalb. He became a devotee when, I forget who it was that was living in Chicago, went and just visited Tamahar and Mantrini when they were just finding out about Krishna consciousness. I forget who it was. And just, you know, through that association, they really liked the devotee and the qualities of the devotee, and they invited him to come to the temple. They came to the temple, and they've given their lives to Krishna's service. So he's now at a stage where he was joking with me and said, you know, we had three daughters, and they're all now married, and they completed their education. We did it. And I thought, you know, now I can turn my attention to full devotional service, and now there's grandchildren. And the grandchildren jump up on your lap, and, you know, you can get just as easily attached to grandchildren as to children. And so I'm saying to my wife, here we go again. And when does it end? And the idea is, there is no end. As long, just like Prahlad Maharaj says to his classmates, don't think you'll do it later, because there's always some arrangement of the material energy to keep one absorbed in illusion. You have to put your foot down and say, no thank you, I want Krishna. Now one can connect those things that are of this world to Krishna. That's what Katvanga Maharaj did. But he did it in such a way that when notice was given, the attachments wasn't like a Jamila. Narayan, my son, save me. False shelters. Fallible soldiers, as the verses in this earlier chapter, the earlier part of this chapter say. So we need to cultivate Krishna consciousness very seriously and sincerely now. As soon as one recognizes that's the right thing to do, then internalize that message, carry it deep within your heart, and nurtured by the watering process of the holy name, let that message grow and grow and grow in your lives. And our Vaishnava Sangha, Vaishnava community, is to help one another do that. Okay, so that's the message for tonight. Continue tomorrow. Lotus feet of Lord Sri Krishna. Any questions? Yes.
Maharaj, you were mentioning that we should always be in the mood of service, and I was thinking how to be in the consciousness, like kind of, what is the red flag, like sometimes you keep doing something and then suddenly something happens and you're like, oh my God, I was not in mood of service. Kind of a red flag, what can be a red flag, or where should the consciousness go the moment you realize, okay, not in mood of service?
Well, especially important, the question you're raising is very broad, so you've given me license to go in any direction I want to go. So here I go. It's very important to see, especially things that are repetitive. It comes again, and it comes again, and, you know, time passes and circumstance pass, but it comes again and it comes again. That's a red flag. That's something that's very prominent, and I need to attend to it. And here's another red flag. The red flag that says, my intelligence says yes, and it's not happening. It means there's a block in the heart. The heart is saying no. Or there's just like this obstacle, attachment, blind spot. It's just the head and the heart have to connect. And there's something blocking over here on the heart side. So there's another red flag. Yeah.
Externally looking, sometimes we have no way of knowing where we are in our attachment from this world.
Oh yes, we do. We have a pretty good idea, and others will help us. Ask Narantra, he'll help you. Ask your friends. Let me pause on that. It's something that Bhakti Tirtha Swami, in one of our Gita Nagari retreats, he gave, you know, one of his spontaneous seminars on different things, and one of the things that he presented, the theme of one evening, like the fireside chats with Bhakti Tirtha Swami, he built a campfire, and so. He was saying it's a good practice to ask the devotees, is there something that I'm doing that makes you uncomfortable? Or something that I'm not doing that makes you uncomfortable? And just put it out there, you know, and be open. And so I was inspired by what he said, and I applied it in many cases of devotional service, and it shows, wow, here's a leader that's open, and you can, you know, you're leaving yourself open when you ask a question like that. So I asked that question of Bhakti Tirtha Swami. He said, there's something that I'm doing that you'd rather not see me do, or the other way around. He said, well, as a matter of fact, that when during kirtan, I like to dance, and you know, it seems like that disturbs you, because you know, when he dances, it's dancing time. and my reply was, it's not because I don't like to dance, but maybe you don't know, I have this, you know, at that time I had a very acute illness condition, and I can't. my heart says yes and my head says no. And he said, I didn't know that. So, you know, this just goes to show, he commented, that by this kind of disclosure, then you can, you know, you can understand another person's situation. And then it enhances the relationship, even just because you've shared that openness with another individual. Of course, that requires a degree of trust in the individual. They're not going to put on their hobnail boots and come storming in. Well, as a matter of fact. Oh, no, you, I cut you off.
Yes, I was going in a different direction. I had my grandmother's father, that must be my great-great grandfather. He had like nine or ten children, and looked like I never met him, but he looked like he led a pretty worldly life. And when he was dying, all these children and grandchildren were sitting around crying and all that, but he was chanting these Sanskrit words from Narayaniyam, describing Krishna from this lotus feet up. And he was like least disturbed by anybody around him. And from the description of, I mean, looking at, he had like 10, 9 children and great grandchildren, and he was not like, from hearing the way he led his life, you know, it was not like something extremely like austere or anything like that. But when he died, this is how he left his body. And so, looking from externally, you would never know that.
Well, if you could have asked him the question, or even without asking him the question, you can understand something was going on, at least internally, if not in, you know, externally in private. So, and this is precisely the message here. The message is, who is really fortunate? That person who can remember the personality of Godhead. It's not the austere person is fortunate or the worldly person is fortunate. Not the person with the long life or the short life. It's bringing the one whose consciousness can be absorbed in the personality of Godhead. Now, what you're indicating is obvious and it's correct, that worldliness is a deterrent. Generally, it indicates attachment to the temporary and forgetfulness of the eternal. Generally, that's what that's the indication. That's the, you know, the puzzle that you're expressing. There must have been something.
He didn't share that with anybody.
Okay, but you can know for certain there's something that was in his makeup, if not, you know, a regular sadhana of some kind. It doesn't just fall from the sky. Now, how do we apply that to our own lives? We're not going to go down the path of...
No.
So?
No. So, one other thing is, Katvanga Maharaj, he was in the planets where the demigods were.
Yeah.
When he asked that question.
Yeah, he came down.
He said, like, one minute. That was 1 minute of their time, or...
Oh. It doesn't elaborate. Because in the second canto it says 1 moment, and then in the 9th canto it's, you know, he has all these thoughts and contemplations, and he leaves there to come to this place, the earth planet, because Shridhar Swami says, our Acharya, Shridhar Swami, the commentator, says, because he saw that the demigods were just, you know, falling head over heel over the opulence that was there. So he was not interested in any part of that stuff as a benediction or even just to hang around. He came there for service and, you know, 23 skidoo, he was out of there. So he came to a place where that wasn't that allurement. And similarly, just like Maharaj Ambarish, his opulence was like that of Vaikuntha. But he was not at all attracted to any of it. And on principle, for further purification of his heart and consciousness, he would regularly go and perform austerities. You know, or like our, you know, the six Goswamis. They were not needing to be austere in order to be protected from allurements. They were happy with austerities. Because the other just didn't, so that was their calling. But then Srila Prabhupada was in that situation and left that situation for the sake of spreading Krishna consciousness. He took sannyas and then came to America, and as he described, his horoscope said that he would become one of the wealthiest people. Krishna took it all away and then gave him even more wealth when he became a sannyasi. But not wealth that he considered his, but wealth that was for Krishna's service only. And he gave up the children and his family, and then had thousands of children as disciples. So whether it's, whether one's life is opulent, apparently, in a worldly sense, it's for service only, for one who's pure in devotion. So Katvanga was able to be in the heavenly planets fighting, but assisting in service, but then leaving there, I have no interest, and leaving his without attachment when notice came. So we should be so fortunate, and that will come by practice, by cultivation now. That's the message. One shouldn't wait. That's the message. Yes?
When you were talking about Maharaj Katvanga, I just remembered one very special moment that you shared. See, when we were in Nagri for my 8th, and Matita Maharaj was giving his lecture at that time, and I was just amazed how he was talking, but it seemed like he was not attached to everything he did, like all the service. But he was concentrated on, like,
In the purport, what you just said just reminded me that in the purport of the Katvanga story from the 9th canto, Prabhupada quotes one verse from Chaitanya Charitamrita, which says that on the platform of pure devotion, one doesn't exactly see varieties of moving and non-moving beings. One sees manifestations of the Supreme Lord. So it's not only at that moment of death, it's before. These are different manifestations of the Lord, and opportunities to serve them are being provided. And that's how one who is situated in pure devotion sees the world, opportunities for service to Krishna. And of course, when one of Krishna's parts and parcels are, or to speak of masses of Krishna's parts and parcels are suffering, it's, you know, you ring the alarm bell. Something must happen. And what can one person do? There's so much suffering in the world. At least I can do my part. And in coordination and cooperation with others, collectively can do more than any one of us alone can do, or collectively, separately, what we can do. And therefore, Prabhupada's compassion was to form the International Society for Krishna Consciousness so that we can Duty calling. Okay. You got the message?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Yes.
Is there any litmus test to find out whether you are really acting in ego or not?
Like, assume that you are. Not just you. Any one of us. Assume that we are. And, you know, you can go the other direction and say, for those that are not, they are like Prahlad Maharaj when, you know, Trinadapi Sunichena Haridas Thakur, completely not considering others are doing this to me when there's some difficulty comes. Why are they doing this to me?
I want to put it as sometimes you put across your views, like we were discussing something on the Bhakti Viksha point of view, some devotees. So trying to put across your point of view, then how do you know that you are talking through ego or just putting across your view?
Assume that you are. No, the transparent position is one of detachment. You're just an instrument of a message. You've understood, you know, to the best of your capacity, this is the message of disciplic succession, and you repeat it. And that's transparent. But, you know, we can understand we've got some filters going on. So we're not fully transparently representing it. And even if we're saying verbatim the message, it's I'm saying the message. So it's until love of God awakens, we can understand false ego is the last of the holds that the material energy places as a covering over the soul.
But in that case, we always be withdrawing to say something then.
So then, yes, what you're saying is true. Now, what to do about that? Just shrug your shoulders and, okay, I'm just going to be forever conditioned by false ego. Or try to act in a mood of service. You take the positive step towards the mood of service, and it withdraws you from that false ego. And continue. And when you're involved in hearing, a further step to remove false ego is hear with great, and the language that we were discussing this afternoon, Prabhupada was using, with great sincerity and respect, or great attentiveness and respect. It will help dissolve false ego. It was right in the purport. The mood of service dissolves false ego. What a relief, huh? It's like Alka-Seltzer. Only it's you can't buy it in a drugstore. Yes, Donna Kelly?
I was just hoping to get a clarification on
I'm not sure I explained it properly either, but...
Well, the part about...
From this afternoon's explanation? The one just now is the standard one. That's easy.
Yeah, but...
How the two connect?
No. My question is, did you say that one, it's considered an offense to the holy name to take the different names of the Lord and put them on different platforms?
Should I read it again?
Well,
I'll read it again so that it's really clear. here's the really clear founder acharya. As far as distinguishing the holy name from the names of demigods, the revealed scriptures disclose, Bhagavad Gita 10:41, that all extraordinary powerful beings are but parts and parcel of the supreme energetic Lord Krishna. Except for the Lord himself, everyone is subordinate. No one is independent of the Lord. Since no one is more powerful or equal to the energy of the Supreme Lord's, no one's name can be as powerful as that of the Lord. By chanting the Lord's holy name, one can derive all the stipulated energy synchronized from all sources. Oh, excuse me. That was today. I'm sorry. We'll go back. Here it is. Yeah. The second offense is to see the holy names of the Lord in terms of worldly distinction. The Lord is the proprietor of all the universes, and therefore he may be known in different places by different names, but that does not in any way qualify the fullness of the Lord. Any nomenclature which is meant for the Supreme Lord is as holy as the others, because they are all meant for the Lord. Such holy names are as powerful as the Lord, and there is no bar from anyone in any part of creation to chant and glorify the Lord by the particular name of the Lord as it is locally understood. They are all auspicious, and one should not distinguish such names of the Lord as material commodities.
Then how does that compare to the statement that we hear that, what is it, 1,000 names of Vishnu equals the name of Brahma, and 3 names of Brahma equals the name of Krishna? That seems to be not accepting all names of the Supreme Lord as equal.
It's definitely not accepting. It's explicitly not accepting.
But here it says...
Yes, I know what it says.
That the names of the Lord...
I got it.
So could you clarify that?
No. No. This explanation that Prabhupada gives here is an unusual explanation. The only thing that I can think of at the moment is they're not material commodities, and they're within the spiritual realm. There's spiritual distinctions, but they're not material distinctions. So just like we can say of, like Rupa Goswami does, the different places, of all the holy places, Mathura is best, and within Mathura, Govardhan is best, and within Govardhan, Radhakund is best. So perfect, more perfect, most perfect, on the spiritual plane, not by material distinction. The material distinction is, I'm from this culture, so my name is best. You're from that culture, so your name is less based upon a material distinction like where you were born. So in any country, any place, names of God, we shouldn't make material distinctions about them. You're a heathen because you don't chant the name of God that I do. I have to contemplate, because again, the explanation is not the normal way that Prabhupada addresses the second offense, but that's the best I can do for the moment.
Okay.
Works. Okay, Jai Radhe? Is this a tricky question? Go ahead.
They have such a name because God has unlimited names, and they just pull up some name which we are not familiar with from our discipline session, and they say this is also an equally valid name, some person is God. And
it must be found within Scripture, that's all. That's the simple solution. In spiritual circles, scriptural reference is required. So someone asserts, blah, blah, blah. Could you show me where blah, blah, blah is found in the Scripture? Without going into examples, that's a simple... Subal.
Guru Maharaj, like the example that you presented when you were visiting your devotee friend in Alachua.
Yeah.
And the situation of, you know, being caught in some of the continuously, increasingly, or whatever complexity that material life brings us, and sort of being caught into that. I wanted to ask you, like, a reminder or, you know, a practical, you know, some solution to when we find ourselves in those situations, you know, that basically you're already in the complex situation and you can sort of, okay, stop. I stop it here. But, you know, you have to be in that. But at the same time, you know, you recognize that you're getting increasingly absorbed in material, in some material, you know, situation. So you want to put a stop to that. How exact? What some advice?
Articulate your question. You know, the punchline of the question. The scenario. I got it. What do you want? You want to know what to do? That's the.
Yes. Well, you in the class. You know, I came late, but you know, the power of.
Someone that's entangled and they're realizing. So if I understood your question, when you find yourself in that predicament, what should be the internal processing that you do when you find yourself in that predicament? That's your question.
Yes, and also in terms of, you know, you recognize that, you know, things are heading the other way. So, you know, you want to turn, it's like you say, the devotee saying, well, you're saying, you know, no, thank you, and, you know, turning towards Krishna.
Well, practically speaking, if you find yourself going, each of us has our own nature. Some people can just stop on a dime and 180 degrees, or at least a 90 degree turn. Some people can just do like that. Most people can't do like that. And most people, it's not advisable to try to do like that because it's too it's too disturbing for the system. So rather than the phrase these days, put a full stop on the thing, recognize I'm headed in the wrong direction. So first thing is remember Krishna. And by what the means one has for remembering Krishna, calling upon Krishna's name. And then get your bearings. And the next is, okay, what direction do I want to move in? And then take steps to go in that direction you want to go in. I heard Tamal Krishnamurti give some very good advice. Well, I heard it from those we gave the advice to, and I considered it very, very wise. It was a career path that had brought people, some two of his disciples, to a position where they were compromised by their profession. And they had family and children. So he said, you know, don't act impulsively. But understand that you're going to need to change the situation. So begin now, making the steps so you can change the situation. And then change the situation. Don't be impulsive. So those, think of Krishna. Consider where you want to go and make some preparations for those steps to get to where you want to go, which is going to be a different place than where you are right now. And then go there. So they shared that with me, and that I was Krishna's instrument to remind them, what steps are you taking? each time I went to the, your Guru Maharaj said, oh yeah. And then, you know, they took some steps and they made some changes and their life is much more peaceful. Both of them are in a different situation, but they're much more peaceful. Oh? So I just added another component, that is ongoing association where you've disclosed, I've been heading in that direction, and I recognize it's not a good direction to be heading in, the direction of increased attachment and whatever it is, and I want to go in another direction. So then you have, it's like a buddy system or a mentor, or you're accountable to someone besides your mind. Because as we know, the mind can be very tricky. And usually is. Oh, someone in whom you can confide in. They'll extend themselves, not in a controlling way or a condescending way or a judging way, but as a friend. That's thinking of your welfare. And a spiritual shelter, person, to help you, give you strength. Ratika, you had your hand up? No? Someone back there? Krishna's last name. I've never heard that question. Krishna's last name. Krishna doesn't have a last name that I know of. Vasudeva and Devaki are his mothers, so he's known by many different names. Vasudev, Krishna. Nandanandana Krishna. Usually it's, that's his last name, and there's some